We're focusing on the final week of Christ. Some had asked today if I had more handouts. If you were not here yesterday and did not have a binder yesterday, they got put into the extra binders either during or after my class. So if you picked up a binder this morning for the first time, the outline should be in there. But if you didn't pick up a binder for the first time today, and you had a binder yesterday, but you didn't get my outline, if you don't have my outline, I have the exact same outline still ready. Does anybody need an outline for my class? It's the same one that was handed out yesterday. There's a few more. If you got one yesterday, this is just a duplicate. It's the same thing. Okay, we talked briefly yesterday about some of the history, some of the different characters that were involved. We talked about Tiberius and his evilness, the vileness of who he was and what he thought and how he believed. And we talked about Pilate. We talked about Pilate and how he was a Roman ruler that personally believed he should have a much better position than being over Judea area and wasn't real happy with it. We also talked about Herod, how he was a Jew but was viewed as a Jew that was really trying to be a Roman. You can understand why the chief priests and many of the different sects of the Jews were very frustrated with Herod and the whole Herod dynasty. Herod Antipas was not the only Herod to be like this. And we talked about a little bit about Caiaphas and the high priesthood and how Caiaphas really, I don't think by this time had been high priest very long, which may be why he was leaning on his father-in-law Annas quite a bit. We talked about how some of the things that went on Sunday. We talked about his entry into Jerusalem, how he made his presence known. He didn't hide himself from the people that were out to get him, which was all the people that we just mentioned, plus a few. We talked about how the people were worshiping him, and we know from the, most of us are probably familiar with this week enough to know that that's going to change, right, in just a few days. They're not going to react to him the same way. And at evening, he went back out to Bethany. We talked about how on Monday, on the way into Jerusalem, he saw a fig tree, and there was no figs, so he cursed it. And we talked about how all the disciples, it said, heard him do that. We were talking about the second cleansing of the temple when we had to pause yesterday afternoon. So we're going to pick up with that account again. The cleansing of the temple, remember, it got the chief priests' attention, it got the rulers of the synagogues, the elders of Jerusalem, it got their attention because they were profiting. This came up again in an earlier class as well. They were profiting from the sale, from the exchanging of the money from Roman into temple. They were profiting from the sale of the animals. Every way they possibly could, they were lining their pockets. And the people knew this, but they couldn't do anything about it. They had a choice. They could either refuse to pay the temple tax, and now they're disobeying God, or they could pay the temple tax knowing that they were being robbed and cheated. And so many of them paid the temple tax, but despised the worship at the temple. Knew they had to do it, didn't want to do it because they understood the hypocrisy and some of the things that were going on. At the end of Luke's account of this cleansing of the temple in Luke 19, verse 48. Well, we'll start with verse 47. And he was teaching daily in the temple, but the chief priests, the scribes, and the leaders of the people sought to destroy him and were unable to do anything, for all the people were very attentive to him. This is the dilemma that Caiaphas finds himself in. He wants Jesus out of the picture. I don't know for sure. It says destroy him. And I'm not convinced that they have completely decided to kill him, although he has previously said, one man must die for the preservation of the many. But he was prophesying, and again, I'm not sure he knew exactly what he was talking about. But I think they're coming to this conclusion. We're going to see it kind of formulate in their mind. But mostly what they're concerned about is they've got to get Jesus out of the way, but they've got to appease the people as well. More and more people are flocking to Jesus. And this happened a couple of different times, and at different points in his time and his teaching, great crowds would be around, and then he would give some really difficult teaching, and people would walk away. And then the crowds would gather again, and his momentum would build, and then he would give some teaching. It's like he's weeding out the flock already on the go. And he's just letting the crowds grow again because there's going to be something very strange and unusual happen in a few days, and it's going to weed out quite a bit. In fact, for a very short period of time, we're told everybody runs, everybody flees pretty much. So he is the chief priests and the leaders are they're really unable to do anything at the moment, and they're kind of afraid to do anything. Now, I have chosen to put this section from the book of John right here, although I can't put my finger on exactly when it may have taken place. All John tells us, we are in John chapter 12, if you're following on your outline. All we know from John is that if John is putting this in chronological order, which it's pretty obvious in other places he doesn't, but I can't put this one anywhere else. It's the arrival into Jerusalem has happened. And after this, he talks about the Last Supper. So somewhere in between Jesus' arrival in Jerusalem and the Last Supper, what we call the Last Supper, usually, these teachings take place. And so I've stuck them here because it seemed like a good place to put them at the moment. But I don't want to skip over them. So we're going to start in verse 20. John chapter 12, verse 20. Now there were certain Greeks among those who came up to worship at the feast. Then they came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida of Galilee, and asked him, saying, Sir, we wish to see Jesus. Philip came and told Andrew, and in turn Andrew and Philip told Jesus. But Jesus answered them, saying, The hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified. Most assuredly I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it produces much grain. He who loves his life will lose it, and he who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, let him follow me, and where I am, there my servant will be also. If anyone serves me, him my Father will honor. Now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose I came to this hour. And I'm going to stop reading right there for just a second. Let's talk about some of this. He says to them, the hour has come that the Son of Man must be glorified. This was a common term that he used for himself. I think they understood he was talking about himself. And he says he's going to be glorified. Now in their mind, he's a king, he's the Messiah, he's the line of Judah. Glorified means we're going to get him on the throne. I think that's an important thing for us to remember the whole way through this session on the last week, is that they thought the culmination of his teaching and everything was going to be kicking out the Romans and taking back control of Jerusalem and Judea and making Israel a world power once again, like it used to be in the days of David and Solomon. Now, we know that that's never what Jesus intended, and that's not what he's predicting here. So for him to say the Son of Man is going to be glorified, and then in the very next breath, start talking about a grain of wheat falling into the ground, we're able to look back and see he's describing his death. He's explaining how his death is going to affect so many people and bring such a great reward. But they're not going to see it that way. He talks about how we have to lose our life in order to save it. He's talked about this before. The apostles later on are going to write very similar things. The idea that we have to give up our own life. We have to deny ourselves, like we were just talking about with Paul. We've got to deny ourselves and then follow him. And in verse 26, he talks about, wherever I am, my servants will be, and whoever serves me, my Father will honor. These are all very grandiose notions, kingship notions. I'm the king, you follow me, my Father will honor you, will glorify you too, just like he's going to glorify me. But then he says in verse 27, my soul is troubled. He's giving more hints to the fact that he is already... How long do you think Jesus thought about his impending death? Did it not cross his mind till the night before? He'd been thinking about this a long time. And already at this point in the week, he uses the phrase, my soul is troubled. He's struggling already a little bit. And I don't use that word struggling in, he doesn't know if he can go through with it. He's struggling in the knowledge of what's going to happen to him. He already perhaps can feel the whips and the nails. You know what I'm talking about? You know you're about to do something that's going to hurt. I hate going to the dentist. I can't even express how much I hate going to the dentist. I have a lot of admiration from... I didn't ask him if I could say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. Last Thursday, my son had to have 6 teeth pulled. Because he's got the same problem I had. It's probably why I don't like dentists. I had to have almost all my baby teeth pulled because they wouldn't fall out. That's traumatic, right? I can sit in the dentist waiting room and you know the smell? When I smell that smell, my mouth can already feel the pinprick of that deadening needle. Anybody else like that? It just, the roof of my mouth already hurts. It already hurts. And, well, it just so happened that day that I had an appointment to get my teeth cleaned and looked at beforehand, and they're shorthanded because of an issue. And so I'm sitting there waiting. I waited a half hour, and I knew Elijah needed this stuff done. And I walked up to the window, and there's still 3 people ahead of me. And I said, would it help if I came back another time? And they said, oh, would you? And I said, sure, no problem. I did go ahead and schedule my next appointment for when we get back, but I sure was happy when I walked out of that office. Didn't bother me a bit. And that's minor compared to what Jesus is about to go through, but I picture something similar in his mind. He can already feel the pain. It's not there, but he knows and has an idea what it's going to be like. So he says, my soul is troubled. And he says, what am I going to do? Ask the Father to save me? Well, he mentions this before, right? At other times. Let this cup pass from me. What can he do? He's only got 2 choices. He can go through with it and offer salvation to the world, or he can not go through with it, and the entire plan of God is gone. There is no backup. He's it. So instead, he says, for this purpose I came. If this is the reason I'm here, then why would I do anything else? Because he is all about doing the will of the Father. So he says, in verse 28, Father, glorify your name. Then a voice came from heaven saying, I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. Therefore the people who stood by and heard it said that it thundered. Others said, an angel has spoken to him. They hear sounds, can't make out the words. They're confused. They don't understand what it is they're hearing. So in verse 30, Jesus explains it to them. This voice did not come because of me, but for your sake. Now this is the judgment of the world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out. And I, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all peoples to myself. This he said, signifying by what death he would die. The Romans did not hang people by a noose, like we're used to hangings. When they lifted somebody up to kill them, it was on a cross. Now there was a lot of different versions, but that's what it was. So verse 34, the people answered him, we have heard from the law that the Christ remains forever. You see how they're thinking? We've read this, that the Christ is eternal. Well, he's going to die, but is he eternal? See, this is something they're having trouble getting their hands wrapped around. How hard is it for us? We've been talking a lot about it, especially today, but even yesterday. How hard is it for us to get our hands around the fact that we're going to die, but yet we're eternal? That's hard. That is a difficult thing to grasp. We've heard from the law that the Christ remains forever. How can you say the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man? If the Son of Man's going to be lifted up, and you're saying the Son of Man, but you're the Messiah, the Christ, and you're eternal, then who are you talking about? They assume he's speaking about somebody else. Then Jesus said to them, a little while longer, the light is with you. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. He who walks in the darkness does not know where he is going. While you have the light, believe in the light that you may become sons of the light. These things Jesus spoke and departed and was hidden from them. But although he had done so many signs before them, they did not believe in him. They've called him a prophet. They've called him the Son of Man. They have alluded to the fact that he might be the Messiah. They've hailed him as the king coming into Jerusalem just a day before. But they don't really believe who he is. It hasn't completely sunk in. Verse 38, that the word of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spoke, Lord, who has believed our report? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Therefore they could not believe, because Isaiah said again, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their hearts, lest they should see with their eyes, lest they should understand with their hearts in turn, so that I should heal them. These things Isaiah spoke when he saw his glory, God's glory, and spoke of him. Now this is an important part, I think. Nevertheless, even among the rulers, many believed in him. But because of the Pharisees, they did not confess him, lest they should be put out of the synagogue, for they loved the praise of men more than the praise of God. We have a new insight right here into what is going on among the leaders of the Jews. Now remember, Caiaphas is trying to keep a religious thumbhold on the population. That's his goal. If he can control them with religion, and Pilate can control them with the Roman law, between the two of them, they stay in power. We talked about that. And Caiaphas here is looking at the fact that this man Jesus is drawing the multitudes away, but there's no way that Caiaphas does not understand that there's some even among his council, even among the elders of the Jews, even maybe among his chief priests, as we were talking about earlier, that are starting to get curious and starting to wonder, that are starting to ask questions, that are starting the beginnings of their belief. And he's losing control. That's part of his dilemma too. It's not just the people. It's his inner circle. This is one of my supposes and wonderings. I've often wondered how many times when the subject of Christ came up, because it was talked about, we know that, over and over, I've often wondered if in the process of those discussions, somebody asked a question or made a statement trying to put their toe in the water to see, is there anybody else here that believes the same way I do? And Caiaphas was picking up on that and maybe trying to shut it down right away, right there. And then later on, here'd be another question or comment or thought about, could he be? And Caiaphas has to smoke that out real fast. And he's just putting out fires all over the place. It's going to add to his stress. Verse 44, then Jesus cried out and said, he who believes in me believes not in me, but in him who sent me. And he who sees me sees him who sent me. I have come as a light into the world, and whoever believes me should not abide in darkness. And if anyone hears my words and does not believe, I do not judge him, for I did not come to judge the world, but to save the world. He who rejects me and does not receive my words has that which judges him. The word that I have spoken will judge him in the last day. For I have not spoken on my own authority, but the Father who sent me gave me a command that I should say and what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that his command is everlasting life. Therefore, whatever I speak, just as the Father has told me, so I speak. Now, this is kind of foreshadowing a little bit. But you remember when he gets into the trials in front of the high priest, and then the next few days, as we go through what's happening here, they're going to constantly try to trip him up in the things that he says. And he tells them very plainly right here, you have what's going to judge you, my words. My words are going to judge you because they're not my words, he says, but they're the Father's words. So the Father is judging you by the things that I say. So when they're asking him later on, did you say this? Did you say that? How do you explain this? He's already told them, the things that I say are very important and you should be listening. You should be paying attention. Because in the end, they're going to judge you. All right. Then toward evening, he goes back to Bethany. We'll turn to Matthew, just if you want to see this. Matthew chapter 21, and verse 17. Then he left them and went out of the city to Bethany. And he lodged there. He goes to Bethany, and in Mark chapter 11, 19 is where we find out that it was toward evening, when evening had come. So we have the end of Monday. He's back in Bethany. Now I want to bring this up. Luke doesn't mention it till later, but I want to bring up really quick a passage in Luke. Luke chapter 21, starting with verse 37. Because we see a little bit of what Jesus' routine appears to have been during this week. And in the daytime he was teaching in the temple, but at night he went out and stayed on the mountain called Olivet. Then early in the morning all the people came into the temple to hear him. I didn't say that reference again. That's Luke 21, 37 and 38, in case you were trying to catch that. His routine seems to have been that he came into Jerusalem during the day and then went back in the evening to Bethany. And then came back to Jerusalem during the day and went back again to Bethany in the evening. And I bring that up because not every time, every day, does it say he went back to Bethany. But I think Luke lets us know in a very general sense that that appears to have been his routine. One of the reasons I'm speculating a little here, but one of the reasons I believe that that may have been his routine, it would have been rather dangerous for him to sleep in the city of Jerusalem. There's way too many factions that are trying to get their hands on him. Now, God could have protected him, but it was going to take some sort of a special measure and was going to disrupt the feast, was going to disrupt his disciples' lives, was going to make things very difficult. He was very comfortable back in Bethany. Who lived in Bethany? Lazarus, Mary, Martha. There's other people. One night it seems he stays perhaps with, or at least eats dinner with, a man by the name of Simon, who apparently had been a leper at one point. So there's people in Bethany. He's very comfortable there. It's close to Jerusalem. But on the main road, if I understand this correctly, on the main road from Jerusalem to Bethany is the Mount of Olives. And this is a view from the Mount of Olives toward Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. It's not hard for me to understand why Jesus enjoyed this place and spent time there. Because from there, he could see across over Jerusalem and especially could see the temple. Now, obviously, that's not the temple. That's that's the mosque that's there right now. But at the time, there would have been a grand, beautiful temple with people milling around and ceremonies going on and music playing and all kinds of things happening. And he could have just sat and viewed this day after day, any time he wanted to, and contemplate and think about what was going on and what was going to happen. So, apparently, we get now to Tuesday. I have to make a correction on your outline, so if you don't have a pen out, you might want to get one. On Tuesday, in the Mark reference, it says Mark 11, 20 to 25. That should be 26. That should be Mark 11, 20 to 26. I didn't want you to think I left that verse out. I just didn't write it down for some reason. And let's go to that passage. Mark 11, 20 through 26. Now in the morning as they passed by, they saw the fig tree dried up from the roots. And Peter, remembering, said to him, Rabbi, look, the fig tree which you cursed has withered away. So Jesus answered and said to them, Have faith in God. For assuredly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, Be removed and be cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that those things he says will be done, will have whatever he says. Therefore I say to you, whatever things you ask when you pray, believe that you receive them, and you'll have them. Peter seems a little, maybe surprised. I'm not sure. This is another one of those places that we've talked about already in other classes, but I'm going to bring it up this class that I'd like to be able to hear. I wish there was MP3 recordings back then. That I could hear the tone of voice that Peter says this. I don't know. I can't imagine that he would be surprised that Jesus had this ability to wither a fig tree. How many other things, amazing things, had he seen that should have technically been impossible, but weren't because God's power was behind it? And that's the lesson that Jesus leaves them with here. God's power should not be underestimated or limited. And it goes way beyond, I think, the idea of prayer here. He's helping them understand that if God's behind them, they can accomplish whatever it needs that they need to accomplish. And they're going to have a lot to do. And a lot of faith is going to be required of them in the next few days. And so he's giving them a foundation. Now I just glanced at the clock and realized that we're not going to be able to spend as much time on some of these things as I'd like to. So if we get to scooting along pretty good in my outline, you'll understand why. Next, when he's there in the day, once they get into Jerusalem, there are some pretty serious confrontations. Mark chapter 11, verse 27, talks about they came into Jerusalem and he was walking around the temple, and the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders, all the important Jews are right there at the temple, and they see him get there, and they congregate. They're still trying to ascertain what to do about this man. Some of them, we talked about, may be actually questioning, is he right? Is he really the Messiah? And some are trying to trip him up in his words. And in Luke chapter 20, they start questioning him. Luke chapter 20, verse 1. Now it happened on one of those days as he taught the people in the temple and preached the gospel, that the chief priests and scribes together with the elders confronted him and spoke to him, saying, "Tell us, by what authority are you doing these things, or who is he who gave you this authority?" But he answered and said to them, "I also will ask you a question, or ask you one thing, and answer me." This was a common concept of Christ, wasn't it? They ask me a question, they think I can't answer, I'm going to ask them something. Verse 4, the baptism of John, was it from heaven or from men? Now that seems like a pretty easy question to answer, but not for them. Verse 5, and they reasoned among themselves, saying, "If we say from heaven, he'll say, why then did you not believe him? But if we say from men, all the people will stone us." See, they're still afraid of the people, even when it comes to John, who's long dead. "For they are persuaded that John was a prophet." So they answered that they didn't know where it was from. "I don't know. I don't want to answer you, so I'm going to say I don't know." So Jesus says in verse 8, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things." They answered the question by not answering the question. And Jesus knew that, and they knew that. So he just says, "Well, I'm not going to tell you either. So if you think it was from God, so am I. If you think it was from men, so am I. You believe what you want to believe. Because I'm not going to answer your question." It's kind of an interesting way to handle them. But he's not done. That's the interesting thing here. Now he goes into a series of parables. And he's not, and these parables have a point. Let's go to Matthew chapter 21. The first parable he gives, and this is right after they've asked him this question, they're still standing there. And he's kind of embarrassed them, but not really. But in verse 28, he starts to really get direct. "But what do you think?" Okay, here's another question. You didn't want to answer that question, I'll ask you another one. "But what do you think? A man had two sons, and he came to the first and said, 'Son, go work today in my vineyard.' He answered and said, 'I will not.' But afterwards he regretted it and went. Then he came to the second and said, 'Likewise.' And he answered and said, 'I go, sir.' But he did not go. Which of the two did the will of his father?" See, another easy question to answer, and they get it right. "They said to him, 'The first.' Jesus said to them, 'Assuredly, I say to you, that tax collectors and harlots enter the kingdom of God before you.'" Is there anything else insulting he could have said to them? These are the very people that they were complaining, right, before, that Jesus and his disciples hung out with. You're inviting them to supper. You're going and sitting down eating. You're talking to them. And now he says, they're going to make it into the kingdom before you do. Verse 32, "For John came to you in the way of righteousness." You didn't believe him. "But tax collectors and harlots believed him. And when you saw it, you did not afterwards relent and believe him." You should. He almost is giving them permission to say, "You know, we messed up." Just like the first son. "We should have paid attention and we didn't, but now we want to." Here's a chance for them to be like that first son and repent and return. Of course, they don't take it. So verse 33, "Hear another parable." Hear another parable. "There was a certain landowner who planted a vineyard and set a hedge around it, dug a wine press in it and built a tower, and he leased it to the vine dressers and went into a far country. Now when the vintage time grew near, he sent his servants to the vine dressers that they might receive its fruit. And the vine dressers took his servants, beat one, killed one, and stoned another. Again he sent other servants more than the first, and they did likewise to them. Then last of all he sent his son to them, saying, 'They will respect my son.' But when the vine dressers saw the son, they said among themselves, 'This is the heir. Come, let us kill him and seize his inheritance.' So they took him and cast him out of the vineyard and killed him. Therefore, when the owner of the vine dresser comes, what will he do to those vine dressers?" Now, if you want You can look at it on your own. We're not going to take the time. Mark gives a little more detail into the parable, some more details that apparently Christ gave with the parable, but we get the gist of it right here. It's an easy allegory for them to understand. It makes sense. But he's talking, right, about the prophets. He's eventually talking about John the Baptist, and then finally he's talking about himself, the Son. He sent his Son, and they're going to throw him out and kill him. Verse 41, then they said to him, he will destroy those wicked men miserably and lease his vineyard to other vine dressers who will render to him the fruits of their seasons. They get it. They understand the story. Let's see if they get the application. Verse 42. Jesus said to them, have you never read in the Scriptures, the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone? This was the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Therefore I say to you, the kingdom of God will be taken from you, and given to a nation bearing the fruits of it. And whoever falls on this stone, it will be broken, but on whomever it falls, it will grind him to powder. He very plainly tells them, you are the ones I'm talking about here. The kingdom is going to be taken by God from you. There's not a lot of wiggle room in what he's saying. It's going to be taken away by you. Verse 45. Well, hold on. Yes. Verse 45. Now when the chief priests and Pharisees heard his parables, they perceived that he was speaking to them. They get it. They catch on now. But when they sought to lay hands on him, they feared the multitudes because they took him for a prophet. Now they're getting more serious. He was an annoyance and a possible problem before. Now he's getting serious. And Jesus isn't going to stop the attack at all. In fact, he's going to keep going in chapter 22. And Jesus answered and spoke to them again by parables and said, the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who arranged a marriage for his son and sent out the servants to call all who were invited to the wedding, and they were not willing to come. Again, he sent out other servants, saying, tell those who are invited, see, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and my fatted calf are killed, and all things are ready. Come to the wedding. But they made light of it and went their own ways, one to his own farm, another to his business. And the rest seized his servants, treated them spitefully, and killed them. But when the king heard about it, he was furious. And he sent out his armies and destroyed those murderers and burned up their city. Then he said to his servants, the wedding is ready, but those who are invited are not worthy. Therefore go into the highways, and as many as you find, invite to the wedding. So those servants went out to the highways and gathered all whom they found, both bad and good, and the wedding hall was filled with guests. But when the king came in to see the guests, he saw a man there who did not have on a wedding garment. So he said to him, friend, how did you come in here without a wedding garment? And he was speechless. Then the king said to the servants, bind him hand and foot, take him away, cast him out into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth, for many are called, but few are chosen. Jesus here points out two different groups of people. One group is going to be a group that were called initially. They were called initially. Everything's ready. Come on. And they don't seem to care at all. They'd rather do something else. We understand this parable, right? What group of people is Jesus referring to there? The Jews. You were called, you should have paid attention, and you refused. So I'm going to find other people. People that you would never expect to see in my hall. Who's that? Gentiles. And they're going to come to my feast, but when the king, God, gets there, there's something out of place. Somebody is trying to be in the wedding feast without the proper garment. And it's noticeable to the king. God notices immediately. Somebody's here that shouldn't be. And they are removed from the situation. Thrown out. So just being invited to the feast was not enough. You had to be willing to come. And just showing up was not enough. You had to follow the instructions. that you were supposed to follow to be there. That's something we should take to heart. Jesus is telling them right off the bat, right there, these are the two groups, this is how it is. This is what the kingdom of heaven is going to be like. Well, because of this, we'll go to Luke chapter 20 and verse 19. And the chief priests and the scribes that very hour sought to lay hands on him, but they feared the people, for they knew he had spoken this parable against them. He is publicly insulting them in front of the people that hold them up and revere them, not because they think they're honorable, because they know they're liars and cheats and hypocrites, but because they have to, because the law says they have to, and they're being publicly defamed, and they don't like it. They don't like it at all. And so now, it seems at this point, his fate is sealed, at least as far as the leaders of the Jews' minds go. They are ready to kill him any minute. Now they're just looking for the opportunity. Up to this point, I think they've been trying to fully realize and decide exactly what to do. And now the decision's been made and they know he's got to die. And they're going to do everything they can to figure out how to make that happen. So now he starts getting questions from them. They've got to get serious about this concept of trying to trip him up, trying to get him to say something that will lend the Romans to be willing to take care of this problem for them. Remember, their problem is twofold. They have to get rid of Jesus, but they can't do it themselves. They have a lot of autonomy, like was mentioned earlier, as far as their laws and their rules. We talked about that Tiberius himself had specifically told Pilate, leave the Jews alone. Let them keep their rituals. Let them keep their laws. As long as it doesn't affect things like my tax money, as long as it doesn't affect the public peace and tranquility in the area, as long as no feathers are ruffled, there's no problems, let them do what they want. And whatever you do, don't meddle in their law. So they've got to come up with some sort of Roman idea. Because if they just take him with Jewish law, Caiaphas probably understands this, he's a good enough politician. If they just take him to Pilate with a Jewish complaint, one of two things is going to happen. Pilate's going to just dismiss it because he's not supposed to meddle in those matters. He's trying to keep Tiberius happy. Or Pilate's going to step out on a limb and take care of the problem based on a Jewish complaint. And now the Jewish leaders have opened themselves up to Roman punishments for Jewish law breaking. And they don't want to do that, because that would be giving up all of Caiaphas' control over to Pilate and Herod. And he doesn't want to do that. So he's got to find something Roman to charge him with. So, in Matthew chapter 22, starting with verse 15, then the Pharisees went and plotted how they might entangle him in his talk. They're actually thinking this through. I mean, it's one thing to be standing there and think off the cuff, oh, maybe I can ask him this. Maybe I can challenge him on this. Maybe I can debate him on this. That's one thing. But they actually go into private quarters and discuss, what can we get him to say? What can we get him to do? How can we get him under the Roman law? So verse 16, and they sent to him their disciples with the Herodians. Now, we've talked about the Herodians a little bit. Who were the Herodians? What? Yeah, they were they were Greek Jews that kind of fell in line with Herod, kind of fell in line with Pilate, but wanted to be Jews too. But they were proselytes, if I understand it correctly. And so they send them and ask this question, "Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God in truth. Nor do you care about anyone, for you do not regard the person of men." What'd they just do? They just buttered him up. Let's get him to thinking about the fact that he's not supposed to judge a person based on who they are or where they come from or anything else. He says, you know, he's taught all the time that a harlot, a tax collector, if they're willing to repent and come back to me, they're on equal footing with everybody else. He's taught these things. He's shown these things by his actions, by eating with them. So now they're going to use that, try to use that, to their advantage. "We know that you do not care about a person. Therefore tell us, what do you think?" Verse 17. "Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" You see how they're now trying to go the Roman route. They're trying to get him to say something that will anger Rome, the nation, the government. Verse 18, "But Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, 'Why do you test me, you hypocrites? Show me the tax money.' So they brought him a denarius," which was right. They didn't bring him a temple tax. You couldn't pay that to Rome. You had to use Roman money. So they bring him Roman money. "He said to them, 'Whose image and inscription is on this?' They said to him, 'Caesar's.'" Dumb question, right? "'Caesar's.' He said to them, 'Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's.'" You give Caesar's money back to him, and you give what God wants back to him. And he wanted worship and praise and honor and obedience. "And when they heard these things, they marveled and left him and went their way. And so will we, because our time is up."